It's now time for Just the Terror with Nick Guerra.
Just Like Grandpa.
On October 23rd, 1989, Colonel Jonathan Sanford passed away in his sleep. 1 year later, I was born. I can remember everyone telling me how much I reminded them of him. As a kid, it was my eyes and my nose. When I was a teenager, it was my build and my hairline. And when I became an adult, apparently, I ended up with the same personality. Those who were able to spend time with him say he was a hard man, but fair. A stern cuss, but the same stern cuss with everyone. I was always envious of my family, even my older brother, because he at least got a few years with him. He was too young to remember any of them, but still. Then, when I was 25, I finally got to meet him, the late John Sanford, my grandfather. My girlfriend Lainey and I had gotten a place for ourselves. We were done with school, we both had jobs, and we were eager to be on our own. For the first few months, everything was great. We had gone through all the haunted house style cliches, flickering lights, creaking floors, things not being where we left them. But we had explanations for all these things. It was an old house, and since there were two of us, things were always getting moved around. But these were not just cliches. We were being haunted. And as I was walking down the hallway one night, I finally saw him. Holy fuck came out of my mouth before I could even think. Chilling cold ran through my face as his transparent hand phased into my cheek, through my mouth, and out the other side. "You mind your language in front of me, boy," he said, pointing at me with a finger that was both pale and brilliant white, but I could see right through. I felt I had no choice other than stand there in stunned silence. I was stupefied by this apparition that looked just like me if 50 years had gone by since the time I left the bathroom. The man who stood before me had lost the hair I was losing now. I could see that. Along with some others, he was still missing the tooth that I had lost 4 years before. But nothing gave it away more than his eyes. They were deep and set exactly the same as mine. And though they had now become limpid pearls matching the rest of what was once his skin, I knew that they had once been called sapphires. He asked me, "Do you know who I am?" I claimed, with an arrogance I was quickly embarrassed of, "Me from the future?" He scolded me, "Don't be an idiot. I'm not you. I'm your mother's father, and I know you heard about me. Now look, I don't have a lot of time, and it takes a lot for me to be able to talk to you. I've been trying to for some time now. You need to listen. Your girl needs your help. She's in danger. You need it." And then he disappeared. I don't know how long I was standing there afterwards. I eventually found my way back to bed and spent a sleepless night with my arms around Lainey. I didn't know what was coming, but I knew I needed to be ready. I considered calling in to work the next day, but I decided I needed to do what I could to get my mind off of the night before. It didn't work though. I spent the whole day distracted. I don't think I got anything done, and my paranoia didn't stop after I got home. That night, every small sound I heard was accompanied by a jolt coursing through my spine. Lainey asked me, "Is something up with you?" as we watched TV. No, it's nothing. I'm just having a hard time getting comfortable for some reason." That wasn't a complete lie. We had taken the couch from my college suite, so it left a lot to be desired where support was concerned. And beyond that, I had spent the entire day being uncomfortable. That night, as we lied in bed, it was pure mental exhaustion that finally made me sleep. And when I awoke, nothing had happened. Nothing had changed at all in any way, and life went on normally for the weeks that followed. I'd come to realize, although I know better now, that the ghost that night just may have been a very vivid dream, which were not uncommon for me, so it was an easily accepted conclusion. I learned quickly, though, that I was wrong. I was very, very wrong. 1 month after our initial meeting, I saw him again. He chose the basement this time, I now realized for privacy. As I turned away from the washing machine, he was there, in front of me. He took no notice or otherwise ignored the shock I knew was plastered on my face. He said, "Listen to me, Johnny. Listen up and listen good. I don't know how long I can stay this time, and there's something you need to do. Your girl depends on it." I was able to fumble out, "Okay, I'm listening. Your girl, she's in danger." I answered, "You said that a month ago. She's still fine." That was when he warned me. "I don't know when it'll happen, but you believe me. It's gonna happen. It's her parents. You have to get rid of her parents."
Part 2.
Before I could ask him what he meant, he was gone. I was so dumbfounded. I didn't know what to do. I stood there, rubbing my eyes even after they had adjusted back to the bleak basement. I knew what I had seen, but it still seemed impossible. I needed to talk with somebody about it, but who? All of my friends would just think that I'm messing with them, and Lainey would accuse me of taking too many of my sleeping pills again. Plus, telling her that her parents were putting her in danger would go over like a lead balloon, especially considering that they lived over 100 miles away now. So going upstairs, I decided best to keep everything to myself for the time being. The time being ended up being 3 days. With the stress of what had happened and the guilt of not telling Lainey, I was cracking. So I decided to tell Lainey I felt sick, which was true after all. Called into work and traveled to the one person I thought might be able to shed some light on the situation, my mother. The 4-hour drive felt even longer with everything I had on my mind, and for the first time in my life, I felt queasy driving up that dead-end hill I spent my childhood on. My mom was thrilled for the surprise visit. Ever since she retired from Cumberland Farms, she spent her days divvied up between QVC and the Food Network. She barreled into me with a comforting hug, and that somewhat relieved my tension. She said, "Well, isn't this a nice surprise?" "Hi, Mom. What do you say we get some lunch? The 5S Diner?" "Oh, that sounds nice," she replied, with her coat already halfway on. "Well, then let's go, Mom. I'll drive." The 5S Diner had been a staple for my family for years. Most people who aren't from the area usually think the name stands for something like steak, seafood, shrimp, and a couple of other things that start with S. But it's actually just named after the street it's on. Growing up, I was here almost every Friday night. Baked haddock with cocktail sauce, a baked potato with sour cream, cottage cheese, and a diet peach Snapple. And don't think people missed an opportunity to tell me that it was the same thing that my grandfather ordered. "John," my mom started after the waitress poured our coffees, "I appreciate the lunch, but don't think I'm simple. I know you didn't come all the way down here just to visit. What do you want?" I had rehearsed what I was going to say on the drive down, but now I was having a hard time finding the words. "Mom, I wanted to ask you about your dad. You spent your whole childhood hearing about him. What could you possibly not know?" "Well, I remember you telling me once that he was the reason we never met Grandma's parents. I was hoping you could tell me more about that." She was obviously uncomfortable. She started shifting in her seat before sitting absolutely straight. "There's really not more to it, Johnny. Your grandma and grandpa were engaged before he shipped out, got married when he got back, and it was just normal for the bride's parents to take a back seat after that." "Mom, I love you, but I know you're lying because you're terrible at it. I need to know what you know. Please, everything you know about this situation. I don't have time to explain. I have to get back home before Lainey gets out of work, and you wouldn't believe me anyway, so please, just talk." My mother was very hesitant to start, but after the waitress had set our food down, she was ready. "Johnny, the first thing you need to understand is that it was a different time back then. Private matters were kept private, and that's the way everyone wanted it. You could tell when people were unhappy, but it was rude to ask. And that's why your grandmother never told anybody that her parents beat her. From the time she was little until after she finished high school, your grandmother, my mother, was an active girl, so she always had excuses for the bruises. And sure, people had their suspicions, but it was one of those things that just got swept under the rug back then. Your grandfather, when he found out what was happening, he proposed to her and had her move in with him. He thought that would put a stop to it, and it did for a while. But when he was called for service and went overseas, there was no other options for my mom but to move back in with her parents, and they went back to their old ways." I thought I could finish the story for her at that point, And then when he came back home, Grandma moved him back with him, right? And since neither of them wanted to see her parents again, they stayed away. And that's why we never met them, right? And that's how we got rid of them? That's why we never heard from them? No, Johnny. Not exactly. My mother struggled with the last part. It wasn't just you and your brother. It wasn't just your father and I. It wasn't just your grandparents. It's more than just our family that didn't hear from your grandma's parents again. After my dad came back from the war, nobody heard from them again. I'd never seen my mom so tense. There was a fear in her eyes that had never been there before. I understood exactly what she meant, but it somehow didn't seem real. And then a freezing cold overtook my entire body, and I heard my grandfather's voice again, as clearly as if it were my own thoughts. That's what you have to do, John. You have to get rid of him. Permanently.
Part 3.
We finished our meals in silence. It was impossible to get warm again, even after putting my jacket back on. I dropped my mom off back at her house and then started the trek back home. The long drive made all the more terrible by the knowledge I received from the trip. I got home just when I needed to. I had just enough time to put pajamas on and get under the blankets on the couch when I saw Lainey's headlights pulling into the driveway. "Hey, baby," I croaked out as she walked in the door. "Hey, how was your day? Are you feeling better?" I answered her, "Not really." It would have been more accurate to tell her everything was a lot worse, but I knew I couldn't tell her what was happening. I knew she wouldn't believe me. We spent the rest of the night sitting on opposite ends of the couch, watching something on Netflix I don't even remember. Lainey was on her computer, and I was still huddled underneath blankets. Around 1, Lainey decided she was going to bed. I told her I was going to stay on the couch for the night. I said it was because I didn't want to get her sick, which sounded better than telling her my ghost grandfather wanted me to kill her parents in order to save her from them, and I needed the night to try to process that. I spent a long time tossing and turning. I was about to finally doze off around 4:30 when he decided to appear again. I closed my eyes and almost immediately felt the room get colder, even through the blankets I had on. Opening my eyes again, I was almost blinded. He was in the center of the room staring right at me. "It's time, John." His voice had a strange, soft authority to it. He seemed ominiscent. I tried arguing. I don't want to. I can't. I don't see why it needs to be done. They don't deserve it. They're good people. "No, John. They're not. Clarks are not good people. One day you understand, but this needs to happen now. You will never have a better opportunity. We have to go now." I could feel myself getting angry. And what if I don't? What if I just don't? I can keep them away from her for the rest of our lives. She'll be safe. Again, I felt the ice of his hand as it passed through my head. "You mind me, boy? Don't you think I stuck around this long just for games, trying to help you? You need to do this." I asked, "What do you mean stuck around? You pretty much just showed up." "I can explain on the way, Johnny. We really do need to go now." I was tired of arguing and just plain tired. He followed me to my car. We started on our way. "Okay, we're going. Please tell me what you meant." "Listen, Johnny, I didn't have time to repeat myself." "Well, that's not exactly true. I have as much time as I could want to repeat myself. I'm just not going to." "Look, when you pass on, you have a choice to make. You either move on and find peace, or you stay. You stay and just watch. It takes a lot to have people see you, and it's very difficult. I was never able to do it until the first time you saw me. But I've always been here, Johnny. While you were growing up, I was never far. And I have to say, you've made me proud. You were good to your mom. You did well in school. You kept yourself off drugs. I did what I could to influence you about some things, but who knows if any of it got through." I had to interject. "It did. Anyway, you've done well up to this point, but this is what it has all been coming to. You need to protect what is yours. It is your responsibility as a man. If you do not protect her from what is coming, then you have failed. But you're a good man, Johnny. I know you can do this. I have to go now. You can see that I'm fading. And he was. He was blinding when he showed up in the living room, but now I could see straight through him to the passenger door on the other side. You have to do this, Johnny. Don't let me down. Do not fail her. Then he was gone. Or maybe he wasn't. I still don't know. I was too tired to try to make sense of what he was talking about. But he was right. I knew what I had to do.
Part 4.
I made it to their house as the sun started coming up. My phone started ringing as I was stepping out of my car. It was Lainey. She must have seen that I was gone. I ignored it. If she ever wanted to speak to me again after this, I would try to explain it then, but I needed to stay focused. This needed to be done. Lainey's parents had given me the key to their place a while before this. I never had a reason to use it until now. I was lucky that their front door opened into their kitchen. I didn't think to bring anything with me, even though I knew what I was about to do. I grabbed the largest kitchen knife I could find and snuck my way upstairs to their bedroom. They were still asleep, spooning, and she was the big spoon. It was surprising. I had known them for years, but they never seemed this affectionate in front of people. I guess that's just how they were, but I didn't let myself get distracted or slowed down. Couldn't afford to. I figured it would be best to do them first. I knew the worst case scenario, them waking up, she would have been a much easier fight. That's not what happened. I felt the freezing cold reassurance of my grandfather run through me, and I plunged that knife inches deep through the ear of the now late Mr. Clark. I left it in for almost a minute, coming to grips with what I had done. But what I had done was the right thing. I knew that. When I took it out, there was a quick spray of blood, and even more continued to ooze out. His wife must have felt that spray. She woke up just enough to see me and recognize me, but she didn't know what was going on before she met the same fate. And then I stood there for a long time, almost in a daze. But after a while, the pride of my accomplishment overcame the shame of my actions. I wrapped them up in their blanket and started dragging them. My luck continued to show, as it seemed they had been working on their vegetable garden just the previous day. I dragged them to the softest patch of dirt I could find. It took some time, but I made a hole big enough for both of them and dropped them in along with my blood-stained clothes. I went back inside, showered as best as I could, and finally, thankfully, got some sleep. I fell asleep with a smile on my face, feeling the pride of a job well done. Lainey was safe. Sleep of the gods. That's the only way I could describe it.
Part 5.
I must have been asleep for a long time, because it was dark outside when I woke up. And I awoke more rested than I had ever been before. I was finally thinking clearly. I don't know what I was thinking, leaving them in that hole and with my clothes. I guess going 2 days with no sleep, company from your grandfather's ghost, and a double murder will really do a number on your mental state. So I waited until first light and went back outside. The early morning air felt great against my naked body. I could feel the goosebumps creeping up along my arms and across my shoulders. I could taste it when I breathed in, sharp and crisp with a wonderful stab inside my throat. Every aspect of the world was more vivid than ever. I didn't see how there could be a downside to that until I dug them back out of that hole. Smell was almost enough to make me vomit. Just ground and decay, dirt and rot, and too many tomatoes. Took a while, but I was eventually able to pull them up with a blanket and drag them back into the house. Instead of bringing them all the way back up to their bedroom, I figured it would be easier to set them up in the living room. I put them in their usual spots on the couch. Their shirts had started to ride up, and I could see that weird tattoo they both had on their stomachs. Some skull with a snake coming out of its mouth that wrapped around to bite its own tail. Something about it always made me uneasy. After they were set, I went to their bedroom and found his lighter. His dad's lighter, he told me once. And when his dad died, he took it. He said he was just a kid and he didn't smoke, but he wanted it anyway. PFC Clark on one side, and on the other some words about how we all sometimes have to do things that just aren't our bag. I never knew I could relate so much to a lighter. I also borrowed some clothes while I was in there. A little big for me, but better than staying naked for the entire drive back. And nobody would have a hard time believing that he had given them to me any random day. Then I made my way back to the kitchen. I turned on all the burners on the stove, then put out all the flames. Then I flicked on that lighter and tossed it into the living room. I got in my car, drove away just in time to see that massive orange fireball in my rearview mirror. About an hour later, I decided to pull over and check my phone. 32 missed calls from Lainey. Well, I'm on my way, I said to myself. Hours later, I pulled into my driveway. When I walked into the house, Lainey was on the couch crying. I asked, "Baby, what is it?" Figuring that the news of what had happened at her parents couldn't have gotten to her by now. I was wrong. "It's my parents," she managed to get out through sniffs and sobs. Someone, I can't believe this happened. Someone burnt down their house." "What?" I tried my best to sound surprised. "They say they were just sitting in the living room and it looks mostly like an accident, but they have evidence of foul play." After about a minute of crying, she forced out, "And where have you been?" I wanted to tell her something, anything, that would make her feel better, but I couldn't. I stood there frozen and couldn't think of any lies. So I told her the truth. It was me. My voice was surprisingly calm when I told her. "It was me, Lainey. I did it. I killed your parents." I could tell she was in shock. She had never been speechless before. I had to just keep going. I know you won't believe this, but it's the truth. My grandfather has apparently been haunting me my whole life, like in a good way. He's always been there with me, and he told me that I had to protect you from your parents. He told me they were bad people and had to go. There's no way he would lie about that. I did what I had to do to protect you. They didn't feel any pain. I made sure of that. But I had a responsibility. She pushed me to the side as she ran upstairs and locked herself in the bedroom. I sat on the couch and waited for when she would be ready to come down and talk with me. But that never happened. I don't know how long it took, but the next thing that happened was red and blue lights flashing through my window. They didn't even knock. The officers that were sent to get me smashed their way in, some through the door, some through the window. I didn't fight them. Part of me knew I had this coming. They cuffed me, and were not gentle about marching me outside and throwing me in the squad car. I didn't see how many there were, but I remember hearing grumblings of, "You'll burn for this," and "You're a monster." But they just didn't understand. I did what I had to do. I did the right thing. When we got to the precinct, they tossed me in what must have been the smallest cell they had. They didn't even bother taking the cuffs off. I don't know how many nights I spent in that cell, but it didn't take long for them to upgrade me to the big house. The trial was just a formality, due process and all that. I confessed as soon as they asked me about it, so it took them no time at all to determine I would be in this maximum security establishment upstate for the rest of my life. Solitary confinement, they decided. It's not all that bad. Every day I get 1 hour of exercise, 1 hour of computer time, and all my meals delivered. When I first got here, I thought I might break. I thought maybe I was really crazy and that I had been hallucinating everything. My mom is the only one that visits me now. Last time she came, she told me about a dream she recently had. Grandpa had visited her. He spoke of how great a kid I was and how great of a man I turned into. Even if I did use swear words. I slept better that night than I ever have. Lainey is safe. And when you love someone, you need to do everything you can to keep them safe.
Rules.
Society is nothing without rules. The world has general rules, typically laws that are common sense to keep people from engaging in their worst impulses. But on top of that, every corner of the world has specific rules. In Appalachian regions, it's believed that whistling in your house after sunset is an invitation for spirits to come inside. In Chinese culture, the number 4 sounds the same as the word death. To avoid bad luck, any instance of 4 is changed into 3A in buildings. seems to be working well. Commonly looked at as superstitions, some rules are warnings that follow a myth or scary tale. There's the one about a library where you mustn't interrupt the girl in the reflective jacket who reads collected ESVM poems to herself until midnight. Or the one about a campsite where you must politely offer some of your food to the faceless people who visit your campfire. An old house where you mustn't look out of the window if you hear the sound of bells. Once again, particular places have particular rules. It might be because they're ancient, special, haunted, cursed, or just particularly beautiful places for other things to make their homes. Sometimes you can learn a little from reading others' lists, others' hard-won knowledge of what is and isn't safe. But spirits are petty and varied. One will tear out your tongue if you speak to it, another will kill you for rudeness if you don't. It takes an expert on the area to know. I don't live anywhere quite like that. I live in the old part of Edinburgh. There's nothing cursed or ancient about my flat. It's actually probably one of the least supernatural places in the city. It's safe. Cities often don't have guardians in quite the same way that rural places have. Forests, lakes, valleys, even big ranches, they'll have owners or rangers or guardians, often passed down through generations or trained and picked carefully by mentors. I like talking to people from those wild places. The guardians, rangers, and owners of forests and lakes and valleys, I respect the hell out of their attitude, their reverence for the places they watch over. I don't have anything that special. I stumbled into this. I'll tell you that story if you're patient. And while I'd rather die than be impolite to something really ancient and fey, sometimes in cities, what you're actually dealing with is a vomit nymph or minor cocaine spirit, and that's occasionally hard to take seriously. But I'm lucky. I tend not to need specific rules. Of course, there's places like the bridge you mustn't walk under if your voice doesn't echo, or Arthur's Seat has its fair share of terrifying things. But for the most part, I'm only really concerned by the universal rules, the ones that pretty much apply anywhere, whether it be an ancient haunted cathedral or the most mundane cafe. If you're hurrying home between 2 a.m. and 4 a.m., don't look behind you. Make sure your bed has your head further from the door than your feet, and ensure at least one side, preferably two, is against a wall. If you're walking past a room and see a person out of the corner of your eye, but when you check again it's just an outfit on a coat hanger, don't freak out, but always, always make sure you check again. Break at least one solemn promise before about mid-February of each year. Close your closet door firmly before sleeping. It's okay if it cracks open so long as it's too narrow for a finger. Stay under your blanket when you sleep. Having a leg out of the blanket is okay, but don't position your feet where they can be seen from under your bed. Windows can slide upwards or open outwards, but must never, ever open inwards. If you feel the intense sensation that something is watching you from the window, ideally close the curtains. You can look from your bed or couch, but never go over to the window and look down, and never, ever press your face against the glass. Only certain people are safe to sleep in complete darkness. You'll know instinctively if you're one of those who needs to keep a light on or a window open. Don't sleep with someone until you've had at least 3 dates. They can't maintain a good, consistent mimic for more than 2 evenings, so after 3, you're safe. On midwinter morning, whichever date you personally celebrate as your winter festival, ensure that at least one sock in your home that has no pair. There's more, but I don't need to tell you them. See, the universal rules have become part of us now. Either they're in our biology, things we've known from birth without needing to be taught them, or they're aspects of culture that get most people to obey them without knowing what they're doing. Some of them, I think, aren't actually universal. For instance, I think the rule that you must offer tea, specifically tea, to strangers in your home is only on this island. The creatures that demand it only really live here. I think some of the rules are culturally dependent. Because, of course, an arbitrary calendar day isn't actually how most non-humans count New Year. It's about the rhythms of your life, and the points in those rhythms where certain things might pay attention to you. Edinburgh doesn't have many rules that you wouldn't get elsewhere, not rules that apply to all of it. You get some heckin' specific rules if you're working in certain parts of the castle at 3 a.m., but really, it's just a matter of common sense. It's a very old city, an important city. Scotland is an old, wild country, and it remembers all sorts of things. It's a beautiful city with so many layers to it and so many ghosts. There are things here you wouldn't imagine, but you don't have to tap on anything 7 times. And if you order a kebab from the man with the tattoo of a swarm of wasps after taking the last train from Glasgow, look, you didn't know how bad a decision that was, but you damn well knew it was a bad idea. At this point, you're probably wondering who the hell I am. I certainly don't have any official position. I don't own any land here. I'm not descended from anyone, and I'm not trained as police or anything. Actually, no human picked me. Seemed random. The night after I moved here, almost 16 years ago, I had the most fantastically vivid dream. I was dancing with the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. She had flame red hair and wore a tattered copper dress. She danced with a sword in each hand, but I wasn't afraid. She moved with such clarity of intent, and she inspired me so much with her grace that I was able to fluidly move around her in perfect timing, and the blades never touched me. I never danced in my life, and I can't dance when I'm awake, but she moved me. That's all I can explain. I was woken up by a knocking on my door. It was the same woman. She said, "I admit, after our dance, I'm feeling a little famished." I invited her in for eggs and bacon. In hindsight, that was stupid. Most magic runs on rules and rituals and the laws of thresholds. Home sanctity and hospitality are some of the oldest of all. There's plenty of things out there which only need an invite into your home to destroy you. But I'm glad I did. She didn't touch the eggs and bacon, but she told me it was a kind and respectful offer. The first thing she told me was about Waverly. Well, no, actually, the first thing she told me was that I needed to get a new coffee machine because my old one was going to break in about 5 more coffees. The second thing she told me was that before getting on a train to Stirling, I should check if there's a stop at Silvery. There is no Silvery on the line to Stirling, at least not unless I'm at the station. I've checked with friends who've confirmed this. It's only there when I am, as far as I know. It's safe for me to get off at Silvery. I have an invitation. It's not safe for you, and you shouldn't try. I saw a teenager try it once, and another man who was probably just counting stops to his normal one and didn't look up from his phone as he got off. Anyway, my day job is in office and I do things with spreadsheets. It's just, you know, in my spare time, I'm one of the people who helps with the rules. There's actually a fair few of us, with as many people and other beings as there are in a big city, but I don't know the others. And I'm telling you all of this because apparently some people don't know all the rules. They just didn't get it somehow. Their parents didn't teach them or their instincts are all wrong. So I figured that I should try to get them out there. Some of these rules are obvious. You know why your closet door must never be wide enough for a long gray finger to curl out from inside and wrap itself slowly around the door. If you don't, please just imagine your reaction were you to see that. Congrats, now you know. Some of them you think you learned better about, you didn't. Adults know it's safe to put your feet on the cracks between the paving stones, but that doesn't mean children are wrong about it being dangerous. The edgelings only take small, tender victims. But some are counterintuitive. George, a local nurse and one of the other part-time guardians, called me up yesterday. That was the call that prompted this. He told me about an awfully weird occurrence at the hospital. Apparently, an elderly patient reported waking up at around 3 a.m., drenched in sweat, hearing nothing but perfect silence. She looked at the door, and in walked a sort of, I hesitate to call it a man. Apparently, it had arms that were far too long and dragged on the floor, only a gaping bloody hole where its eyes should be, and a torso that wrapped around in spirals like a knotted rope. The man stopped in the doorway, breathing heavily, and then reached out with one hand. It seemed like his feet couldn't pass the doorway, apparently, but his hands could. Walking his fingers across the floor, then eventually taking a deep breath and supporting the full weight of that awfully long arm, he groped along the beds of the ward until he reached hers. When he touched her feet, his hands weren't cold. They were warm, slimy, a little suctiony. Something told her to remain perfectly still, not to react, not to give any sign of life. The moist, heavy fingers explored her toes a little bit, lifted her heel, and then dropped her foot. The long-armed creature sighed heavily. No tasty eyes here, it whined. Need tasty eyes. It took a deep breath, coughed up some slime, and whimpered like a child begging for ice cream. Delicious eyes. And then it left. Apparently, the doctors think the woman is crazy. There's absolutely no sign of the creature on the hospital CCTV. No slime where it supposedly coughed. But George is the nurse that helps old people get cleaned up. And he says her feet were sticky. In a way that turned his stomach. And George's stomach is strong enough to clean pus out of a guy who decided to stick his penis up the open surgical wounds in his own arm and then laugh about it over a pint. George mentioned he's damn glad his patient was sleeping with her head and her eyes away from the door and her feet towards it. He made sure it's hospital policy to ask all patients to sleep that way. I thought it might be valuable to let you all know.
Rules, don't look.
Now, I hope I haven't scared you off of Edinburgh. It's a beautiful city. Every time I bring up rules to other people, people are quick to mention rules that they follow. Don't look in mirrors in dark rooms. Don't rush or act afraid when you sense something behind you and so on. Don't look over your shoulders at what might be following you. So I thought I'd write something about those rules to help explain and to help deter the few of you who think you'll go around glaring defiantly behind you as if you can prove me wrong. You know you can't do that. You know how strong that instinct is that you shouldn't look, and you know that nobody told you. You got it from somewhere deep within you. It's convenient because this is also the story of how I met George. I was, I'm just going to be honest with you, out late at night, mildly tipsy, buying a deep-fried Mars bar. For those who don't live in regions where this exquisite cuisine is possible, you're just going to have to believe me that it's good. It just is. Moving on. I left with my battered prize and was about to sink my teeth in when I saw him. A young man, dark-haired, coat turned up against the cold. I approved of the coat and his sensible woven scarf. I saw him throw a look over his shoulder as he passed. I didn't approve of that so much. And then I saw his shadow become ever so very slightly larger. I knew about the thing behind you, even back then. I wouldn't have been allowed to do this job without at least some preparation, but I'd never seen it hunt in real time before, never been the bystander as it got started. If I called to the young man, would that make him look again? If I followed him, that definitely wouldn't help. I didn't know him, but I just couldn't let this happen. I made a snap decision and broke into a sprint. I'd circle round the hill and meet him on the other end of the street. It'd been raining and my feet slipped a little over the cobblestones, the cold air rushing into my ears for an instant headache. I needed to be in front of this guy. I saw him again as he hurried round the corner and threw another anxious glance behind him. I called out, "You've got to stop doing that." Dude looked at me like I was crazy, glanced at me, glanced behind him, and then back at me. "Are you talking to me?" A pipe was dripping water into the gutter at the corner of the square. Each droplet stood out to me in the darkness, tiny pearls gilded by reflected lamplight. I don't know what George was hearing, but I could tell the rhythm of that drip wasn't entirely natural. Drip, 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 drip. Pause, and then would drip, 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 drip again. "Yes, I need you to stop looking behind you." After a moment's thought, I added, "Because there's nothing behind you." The shadow shrank just a little bit. I hadn't practiced this, I've never done this before, and my facial expression must have given it away, and the young man noticed. His shadow grew, and this time it wasn't a subtle difference. It looked like someone was shining a torch right under his feet to cast a shadow that big. The shadow loomed up on the crescent behind George, broken up by the shapes of Edinburgh's typical tall windows, and cut off just at the neck by the dark tiles of the roofs. He accused, but he didn't turn around. "You're looking behind me." That was good. I approved of that. Sensible scarf boy might have forgotten the rules, but at least he could see it once I reminded him. I made a series of rapid plans in my head, all discarded. It was imperative that he calm down. It was absolutely imperative that he didn't look behind him. I needed him not to see that shadow at all costs. I would have been more than happy to blind him, but I wasn't entirely sure how to achieve that from a distance with the two pens, keys, and a phone in my pocket. And I sure as hell wasn't chancing a wrestling match. Trying to somehow look as though I was both non-threatening and a total professional, I skipped the last few steps to the dark-haired man, grabbed his arm, and started down the street. I was almost surprised when he complied, but then I looked over at him. Now I was closer, I could see the tears in his eyes. The man accused in a whisper, "You know what's behind me." I admitted, I do, and it feeds on fear, so I need you to stop thinking about that. I want you to think about the fact that I'm taking you to a safe place. I want you to think about, deep-fried Mars bars. I realized as I said it that I still had the damn thing in my hands and offered him a bite. He accepted, trembling. I'd like you to focus on telling me your name and what you'd like to make for breakfast tomorrow. We were walking briskly, and I had a grip on his forearm that was a little too hard. I shifted it to his shoulder. The thing behind me was substantial enough now that it was casting its own shadow. I prayed he didn't notice. I couldn't make out much from the shadow, but it looked like it had a pretty long knife. "George," was all he offered in response. I suppose that's fair, given how terrified he was. "Okay, George. My place is too far. We're just going to pop into the library. That's a couple of streets over." There are three sets of footsteps on the cobblestones. I hurried mine along, wanting to make sure George didn't notice. Kept up a patter of completely meaningless talk. The thing behind George's knife got longer. The relief when I saw the light spilling from the front door of my local library absolutely drenched me. I kept a steady, brisk pace up to the front door, shoved George inside, and shut the door behind us. It was only a glass door, it wouldn't hold. I drew George further into the library, found a chair I could position in the corner, and made sure he had his back to two walls before we relaxed. Both of us were breathing hard in the sudden quiet. George was the first to break the silence when he said, "That was one of the other you just handled for me, wasn't it?" I froze. George wasn't supposed to be asking about that. Why would he know about that? He reassured me. "It's okay. I'm a guardian too. Just, I kind of inherited and I don't know what I'm doing yet." So I told him the rules. Not to ever look behind him if he's on a dark street like that. If it's targeted you once, you're more vulnerable. I told him how it progresses. At first, it's your shadow. You don't believe in it, it's not strong enough to do much or to hurt you. But when you glance behind you and perhaps you see a leaf stirring in the wind or an oddly shaped shadow, it lends just a little credibility to the idea that maybe there could be, or could have been, something there. That little bit of belief is enough to give it power. Still not enough power to hurt you, still not enough to take physical form, even, but enough perhaps to change the way a water pipe drips or nudge the air to blow a little differently. You think you hear something behind you, so you look over your shoulder again. That little bit of extra belief still won't give it physical form, but it can nudge things. It can make the air feel warmer on your neck. It can make the street seem quiet, too quiet. It could lengthen your shadow so that if you turn around and glance at it, something might seem off. You believe something is off, something is dangerous. Perhaps you believe a little bit that there might be something behind you. It gets stronger. I told him all this before realizing I had made a terrible mistake. Have you ever read or told a story that scared you so hard your eyes watered from the sheer mental strain of it all? Like your fear was leaking in liquid form from the nearest outlet? I'd made sure George had his back to a wall. I hadn't done the same for myself, and my tears were blurring my vision. I wiped them away and noticed George was a little more scared than I expected from simply hearing about a monster, at least from a guardian. I asked in the most measured, calm voice I could possibly summon, "Is there something behind me?" George answered, "Absolutely not." A book fell on my head. "There is definitely nothing behind you." I could feel the breath on my neck just as I mentioned it. I wish I hadn't used that example. I hate breath on my neck. "Please look at me." I think in hindsight, George's nurse training kicked in. I looked at him, tried to actually stop scanning the empty library aisle for anything to help, and looked at him, right into his eyes. "There is absolutely nothing behind you. There never has been. You're safe. You are completely safe," George said. I stood up. "There's one last thing you can try in an emergency. It works best if you trust someone with your life, but George is all I had. I walked towards him, took his hands, and pulled him up. I almost slipped his hands out of mine. They were so sweaty. I asked, knowing how terrible it was for me to ask, "Would you prove there's nothing behind me for me? Could we stand back to back?" The ordinary nurse, who never wanted any of this, looked over my shoulder. He visibly flinched. I felt the sensation of someone behind me slipping a knife around, poised in front of my throat. George closed his eyes and rapidly took two steps past me, directly into whatever was behind me. But there was no sound. I felt his back pressed against mine, trembling. There was no knife against my throat. I reached behind me and held his hands, and we stood like that for a while, breathing in tune, hearts thudding like rabbits, knowing the only things behind us were small or harmless enough for the other to face them for a stranger. Anyway, that's how I met George. Of course, I couldn't stop it. The thing behind me got its prey that night, though it wasn't either of us. I saw her that Sunday afternoon, a woman hurrying past on a half-empty street who looked like she'd been thrown out with the trash and not combed her hair since. She was stumbling a little, wearing office clothes, looking like she was late for getting fired. Sleep deprivation was absolutely etched into her face, far too wrinkled for the age she looked like she should be. She didn't even look up or notice us as she stumbled past. She'd probably learned by then. Looking the way the tiredness had made her, people who heard her pleas for help would assume she was crazy, a homeless beggar or a drug addict. I knew better, but I also knew better than to try to save her at this point. Right as she almost disappeared from view, she threw a glance over her shoulder, and just as she did, another woman rounded the corner, coming the same way she'd come, so they barely glimpsed at each other before the first woman disappeared from view. Younger looking, prettier since she wasn't a wreck, better dressed, you never noticed she looked exactly like the first woman. She walked with the most perfectly measured, patient step. When I blinked again, she was gone. I checked the obituaries, always, in coroner's notes and crime reports. Officially, this woman died of some kind of mental illness or drug overdose. She went crazy, that's for certain. That's good. You're supposed to go crazy when you're sufficiently sleep-deprived. It's one of the oldest defenses we have. It prevents you being completely sure that the thing behind you is what kills you. So, don't glance behind you when you're hurrying home late at night. You already know this rule. You know it for a reason. I'm doing my best to keep you safe. It was risky to say this, and risky to make you believe a little more. So you better have followed all the instructions. Sleep with one side of your bed against the wall. Tell your friends that they shouldn't be glancing over their shoulders, because it'll only make them more scared. And if you get up to use the bathroom and you're still anxious from reading this, don't look in the mirror.
Rules step on a crack.
The funny thing about society is they love their rules to feel a little fun. "A spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down" was inspired by the way the songwriter's son was given his polio vaccine. It was dabbed onto a cube of sugar and taken orally. Sometimes people might take a rule and change a word or two, or make it rhyme. "An apple a day keeps the doctor away," "click it or tick it." Maybe it helps people get over the dread of the outcome of breaking a rule. But the problem in altering the wording of a rule might do more harm in the long run. We've all heard the "step on a crack and you'll break your mother's back." Now, this rule has been rewritten more than once. If you do a quick Google search, you'll find that at one point it was written as a warning to keep people aware of broken sidewalks. You'll even find a racist version of this rhyme. But guardians know the original version. "Step on a crack and your mom won't get you back." You see, edgelings like to pull little children that step on cracks into their part of the world. It's usually not for malicious reasons. Just as we don't understand everything about them, they don't understand everything about us. In this case, edgelings just don't understand how humans can't be pulled through cracks unscathed. But before I continue on, I want to clarify something. After posting the first two stories, many people have asked for help with specific situations. My rule for specific help? You have to speak to me in person. How exactly to communicate with guardians? Well, that varies. There isn't really a system, just a patchwork. If there's nobody who knows how to keep the peace between humans and the others in a particular area, either humans will stop living there, or someone will end up doing the job, whether they inherit it, learn it, are appointed, or are cursed with it. So if you need help, the methods vary. Some of us are, not gonna lie to you, kind of terrible. Those folks just sort of wander the streets waiting for the supernatural to bump into them so they can sternly tell it off. There's others who have artifacts or helpers to detect signs of folks in need. No, we do not all have a group chat. I've just met a few of us over the years. I'm afraid I'm not the people-oriented type. I know where the bad guys are, but I just try to handle them in priority order, depending on how risky they are. I don't actually know if they're currently endangering anyone specific, unless I literally see something crash through your window. Even what I've got, I'm lucky to have. I'm only human, but I'm also a dancer. My dancing partner is quite special. I know when people have broken rules, important rules, because the dark things will tell me. Last night, for instance, they whispered a name to me, someone who'd looked out her window at precisely the wrong time and seen something she shouldn't. Something that didn't like to be seen. They told me her life was forfeit. I agreed that I wouldn't try to save her, because letting them take the ones who offend them is why they leave the rest of us alone. I maybe could have found out where she lived, gone over, somehow persuaded her to salt every window and threshold, and gotten her to wear silver on both wrists and any finger she wanted to keep. But I have my limits. I'm always so busy over the holiday period, so I let her go. By now, I'm used to letting people go, but letting go wasn't easy in the beginning. In my early days, I was fanatical about all of this. I thought this guardian thing made me invincible. So when the wanted posters went up for a little girl named Brioni, the daughter of a friend who helped me move, I didn't care if she was kidnapped by a human or personally picked out for slaughter by the Grey herself. I wanted her back. I took the train to Stirling. I got off at Silvery. It doesn't look like a normal train station, so don't worry. You're unlikely to get off there by accident unless you're really not paying attention. I mean, it takes effort. There's a gray concrete platform, a little red brick station house with neat wooden rain shelters painted navy blue, a big sign in the same shade of blue that announces its name in that sort of font. But it's deserted, even in rush hour. The trees behind the platform are too tall and thick to see what's beyond them, and there's cats everywhere. And well, it's too nice. Even in Scotland, public funding doesn't cover lampposts encrusted with emeralds, a wrought iron fence shaped like interleaved flowers, and a little fountain. Anyway, I got off and waited until the train disappeared beyond the horizon. Then I knelt by the fountain and thoroughly scrubbed my hands, my face, and, removing my shoes, my feet. My exit from the station was barred by a smiling young man with the most fabulously shiny hair. Why, hello there. It's a lovely day to meet someone of such fine sort. May I just check if you're sure you intend to enter here? If you're lost, I'd be more than happy to help you home. I answered back, and it is a fantastic day to be greeted so kindly by such a proper young gentleman. I do so very appreciate your offer of help, but please don't worry about me at all. I have an invitation here. The Fae nodded his head, perfectly politely, and stepped elegantly aside to let me pass. In the trees, the station was swallowed up behind me very quickly. It didn't take more than a few minutes walk before I started seeing signs of other inhabitants. All of them were lovely. The perfect graceful deer who bounded and leaped over the shining green ferns. The sweet little multicolored lanterns hung in the trees to mark the path. The flute music echoing from somewhere above me. The children who played in a clearing with their pet dogs and pet human, bright-eyed and golden-haired. I paused to watch as a sweet little fae girl pet the human's hair, ripped his arm off cleanly, and threw it across the clearing, calling fetch. I blinked for a moment as my mind processed that, but no, of course that was lovely. They were only plain. So lovely. Like the lovely dancers twirling on a huge oak branch above me and the lovely flowers growing on a path, and the lovely laughter of the children as they watched the human stumble in tears after his limbs. Everything in the Seely Court is polite and lovely and sweet. The meadow I was looking for showed itself to me after I'd been wandering perhaps half an hour. A crowd was gathered around a string quartet playing music in a key I couldn't identify. I've never been able to identify it. No matter how many times I've been back, I eventually figured out why. No matter what notes they play, what sharps or flats, what sevenths or fourths, what chords of 13 notes at once, everything simply sounds lovely. My dancing partner wasn't there, so I couldn't dance. I can't ever dance well without her, and to dance badly would risk being rude. I waited on the edge of the field, looking at nothing in particular. There was a rustling behind me in the leaves. I turned and instinctively knelt. A friendly voice cooed, "Ah, it's the little sea-eyed one from Edinburgh." A finger lifted my chin, and I was staring up at emerald skin, a perfect strong jaw, mossy hair longer than I could follow, kind eyes, and velvet lips. "Do you bring gifts?" Mutely, I reached into my pocket and offered a little silver necklace I picked up at a charity shop. It didn't matter that it was cheap. It was old. "Oh, lovely. Why don't you stand?" I was asked. I hesitated. Sometimes this is a trap. "Simply because I wouldn't want to give any insult," I answered. A laugh. "Rise. I give my permission. I know what you're here for. I don't think you want it, though." Getting to my feet was easy. I sprung up full of energy and joy. "I just need to know where she is. I don't think she did anything wrong. I want her to be safe. I'm willing to pay." The meadow seemed to get a little darker. I noticed a few people looking at me with strange smiles far too wide. But of course," I hurriedly added, "only if that wouldn't be any trouble. I'd hate to bother you with my petty human affairs." Those eyes studied me for a long time before the Fae concluded. "You're very lucky she likes you." My smile and thanks came easy. I was lucky. The fairy led me into the woods, underneath the trees. They enveloped me again within moments, and only moments later I realized I was being taken out of Seely Court. The darkness flowed thick as oil between the flimsy branches, and the path was slick with rotting, fallen leaves. We walked into a tunnel formed by an arch of holly over our heads. No brambles or blackberries. Wait, was that woven roots? Before long, it was stone. I looked up, overwhelmed, and saw a vast opening in the sky, a sheer cliff of blinding brightness. Its neat edges stood in stark contrast to the crumbling mud walls. I was confronted by a slender, whip-like serpentine humanoid with coiling blades for limbs and staring yellow eyes. It was a creature I now know to call an edgeling. It leaned deeply into me, almost touching my neck as it sniffed around my shoulder. It sniffed. "Ah, yes. Ah, yes." I looked behind me. My fairy guide had melted back into the woods. The edgeling's long, thread-like tongue touched my shoulder, and I startled backwards into a wall. I told the edgeling, "I just want Brioni." It snickered, spat, and turned away from me. "Are you sure?" I drew myself up to my full height, straightened my shoulders, and thought of the look of fire in my dancing partner's eyes. I remembered the minor demon I had fought off the week before, thought of Brioni's mother's grief, and stiffened my spine. "I'm the guardian of old Edinburgh, and I'm speaking to you on behalf of humans. You can't just take little children. Yes, I want her back, or my friends will hear about it," I snapped as I stared him down. And then I woke up, back in my bed. That wasn't too strange. Sometimes leaving Silvery is a little strange. I've ended up in far worse places. I figured it was a good sign. I'd been listened to, respected. So I went about my day. I was cleaning the kitchen when I got a knock at my door. I went to answer it, but there was nobody there. Just a long, thin strip of meat curled up on my doorstep. Some kind of offering from some variety of murdery ghost cat? I had no real idea to the limits of what I might be dealing with back then. I decided to leave it where it was for now until I figured out what to do and shut the door. No sooner had I shut it than there was another knock. Confused, I swung around and opened the door again. Nothing stared me in the face. I looked down and there was another long, thin strip of bloody meat. I ignored them when they knocked the third time. Just kept on cleaning my windows and doing my dishes. After I got started on cleaning my carpet, the knocking got insistent. I went to look again, this time just through my keyhole. The pile of meat had grown alarmingly, but nothing seemed dangerous, so I opened the door. The curled up pieces had been straightened out. The puddle of blood was growing, but not alarmingly. This wasn't fresh meat. But something near the end looked like a foot. Almost a shredded one. Sickened, I closed the door, put noise-canceling headphones on, and did a day's worth of spreadsheets on my laptop. I almost managed to forget about the knocking until I realized I had no milk and would need to step out if I wanted a cup of tea. When I opened my door again, I threw up. They reassembled Brioni on my doorstep like a jigsaw. Each slice the width of a human-height steak. The moist pieces slid apart from one another, so despite her skin being perfectly preserved, I could see in the gaps into her brain, her lungs, the neatly cracked bones of her thighs. I realized rather swiftly that I should get this inside. The police don't necessarily need to know about the supernatural, and I didn't fancy explaining the corpse to them. I managed to gather the stuff. I'm refusing to think of it as the actual corpse of some poor kid. Onto a plastic sheet in my kitchen. Though a few pieces slid out and unthreaded themselves from the mess, slapping softly onto my carpet. Why did I have white carpet? Why was that a thought on my mind anyway? I felt awful. I felt responsible. My mind decided to start counting the specks in the glass of my kitchen window rather than feel those feelings. One more knock. Almost so soft, I didn't hear it. I wasn't sure if it was real, but I went to the door. I just felt compelled to. Outside, it was a slice through a person, just a tattered diagonal slash. Half a pupil, half an eyelash, a centimeter of twitching lip, a few hairs that sprouted from the top and hung down to cover the exposed brain matter, and a fascinating slice of chest with a tiny bit of heart tissue expanding in and out behind the skin, pumping blood that leaked down its skin to nowhere. A single toe. She was alive. She hopped towards me, but then it was just too much to keep her balance. She seemed to find it easier to slither. I reached out my arm. She curled around it, lifting that single eye like a snake so she could look into mine. I told her, "I'm so sorry." I broke down sobbing. I'm so sorry. I have no idea. I'm just sorry. I'm so sorry. I think she caught sight of the pile in my kitchen because she stiffened on my arm. I quickly moved through into my lounge. After sitting with her and simply weeping for what felt like forever, I realized I should ask her, "Does it hurt?" The eyes stared into mine. A single teardrop fell. I learned my lesson. I got what I asked for. I got her back, not in the way I wanted it. I knew I had to let her go. So, I broke her neck. Judge me if you want to. You can hate me for it. Just don't step on the cracks. Thank you for listening to Just the Terror with Nick Guerra. Make sure to check out True Scary Stories with Edie on Tuesdays. Give it 5 stars. Stay scared, uglies.